This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. My co-host, Magna Chakrabarty, is off today. Our week in review begins with new information about the possible motives of marathon bombing suspect Jahar Tsarnaev, as well as concerns by some over what we still don't know.
Where he trained, when he trained, how he trained, and who he trained with, and if there's other people that he trained with that are still plotting against the United States.
Also, in the wake of the bombings, an unequivocal vote of no confidence in Boston Fire Chief Steve Abrera from his deputies and what it means.
Well, I think he views himself as the guy who does the big picture. He leaves the incident command to the deputy chief at the scene.
And Kenneth Feinberg, the essential man on his plan to distribute more than $30 million to the bombing victims and their families.
As the mayor of Boston and the governor of Massachusetts have told me, get the money out fast with a minimum of complexity.
Plus, Governor Deval Patrick shares lessons learned while leading the Commonwealth in a time of crisis.
The importance of sharing information and doing so promptly cannot be overstated.
We'll dive into those topics and our weekly hubbubs with two stalwarts from our Week in Review team. Peter Canellos, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe, joins us. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Anthony.
Thanks for being there. Also with us in the studio, Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston and a columnist for the Boston Globe. And Renee, it's great to have you back.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So let's begin today with the latest on the investigation into the marathon bombing. Peter, as your paper reported on the front page today, just before his capture last month, Jahar Tsarnaev scrawled a note inside the boat in which he was hiding that seemed to take responsibility for his role in the attack. That, according to law enforcement officials quoted by the Globe. So tell us more about what we know about this and what this means to the prosecution's case against Tsarnaev.
Well, it certainly helps the prosecution's case. It almost reads like a suicide note. He expected to die, and so he's laying out for posterity why he and his brother did this. He describes Tamerlan as being a martyr, and the victims of the bombing as collateral damage, and compares them to Muslims who were killed in various American actions in Iraq and Afghanistan and places like that.
Mm. So it would seem, Renee, that it would help in this way. The government interrogated Tsarnaev before he was read his Miranda rights, so presumably a lot of what he told them about his motives and involvement might not stand up in court, but this note presumably would.
Sure. If this can be entered as evidence, and I don't see offhand why not, I think it very much strengthens the prosecution's case. I still think it's going to be difficult for the prosecution to get a jury here in Suffolk County, and probably there'll be this trial, when it gets going, will be moved. Because there's been a lot of, all of this publicity about all of these details, understandably and correctly. But I think it makes it difficult to get, impartial or disinterested jury.
Mm. Do you agree with that, Peter?
I think that probably will be what happens, yes. I do feel this may go on to the point that you were making about Gabriel Gomez up ahead. I do feel that it's very, very important that he be tried in the regular federal system, though, and that's more important than doing it here in Boston, though I certainly understand why people in Boston are very anxious to have it happen here.
Sure. Well, speaking of Gabriel Gomez, we're going to move to that next, and it's interesting how this case featured on the campaign trail this week. Our own Bob Oakes spoke with the Republican U.S. Senate candidate Gabriel Gomez, who said he thinks the government should have held the bombing suspect, Jahar Tsarnaev, as an enemy combatant from the very start to allow for more questioning. Here's what he told us.
We could have continued questioning him because we still don't know where he trained, when he trained, how he trained, and who he trained with, and if there's other people that he trained with that are still plotting against the United States. I don't understand why we gave up that option when we had that option within our power.
Renee, I was a little surprised to hear Gabriel Gomez making that argument. What did you make of it?
He did say in the primary, as his primary opponent, Michael Sullivan, also said, that Gomez should be tried as an enemy combatant. First you have to strip him of his American citizenship first, though. I think it's, I'm not really sure it's necessary or even proper. It seems a little bit like grandstanding to me. Gomez was saying that he should not have been read his Miranda rights. I think we have a system here. It's been proven to work well in other, national security kind of terrorist type events, and we ought to stick with the system we have.
Yeah, and Peter, what about you? Is there any reason to believe why the civilian judicial system couldn't handle a case like this?
No, and I also think further it would be illegal to declare him an enemy combatant. I mean, the president's right. declaring people enemy combatant based on the grant of power after 9/11 to take on the enemies who attacked us in 9/11 and other related groups. There's no evidence at all that Zhahar Tsarnaev was part of any of those groups. So, you know, if the president can declare him an enemy combatant, they could declare anyone with a grievance against the United States an enemy combatant. And the second thing I would say is, you know, we're in a political atmosphere where they don't even want to bury Tamerlan Tsarnaev, so mm-hmm. I can understand why Gomez feels like this might be a beneficial issue to him. You know, but the issue isn't fairness to Zhahar Tsarnaev. It's upholding the regular judicial system. It's a it's a defense of the American system, because if you feel like it's not capable of handling this case, when let's face it, he's going to be found guilty. I mean, the evidence is right there on the boat. If you need it anywhere else, you know, if the justice system can't be trusted in this case, what can it be trusted with? You know,
yeah.
Amen. what he said.
All right, what he said. Let's move on to another related story. This week, we learned that 11 days after the bombings, 13 of 14 deputy chiefs from the Boston Fire Department sharply criticized their supervisor, Fire Chief Steve Abrea. In a scathing letter to Mayor Menino, the deputies claim Abrea's leadership was inadequate after the Marathon bombings. The deputies wrote, "You can unequivocally consider this letter a vote of no confidence in Chief Abrea." Peter, what exactly are they claiming Abrea did not do?
What they say is that the chief on the scene should assume command responsibility, that is, you know, overseeing the actual firefighters, or designating specifically somebody to oversee the firefighters, but also kind of supervising the situation, and that Abrea absolutely didn't do that. Mm. That's their claim. But this comes in a context of a lot of tension over the chief being a non-union person, being an outsider. And the tensions between the deputy chiefs and the chief were something that was kind of built into the system from day one. So people have to view it in that context as well.
Yeah, Renee, talk about this larger context and I guess what it means about the way the fire department is running, could be run in the future.
Right. You know, the city council has called for a hearing into this matter, but really it feels to me like what these people really need is some marriage counseling. I mean, you know, the chief, Abrea, has been an outsider from the get-go. You know, he was the first chief of the department to be hired from outside of Boston. He's the first minority. It's a peculiar position, you know, the fire chief, because it is, as Peter said, the only non-union uniformed officer in that department, so that all of these deputy chiefs who are complaining about his leadership are members of the union. And there's a lot of, you know, longstanding tensions. You know, the union is in many of disputes with the management of the department over changes that want to be made. You know, so it does seem that perhaps, you know, from what I've read in the reports in the Globe, that you know, there may be a style issue. He seems to be somewhat aloof or disengaged from the department compared to some previous chiefs. But, you know, whether that's a dereliction of duty, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think it just seems to be that people need to get down and talk to each other.
I like your suggestion about marriage counselor, marriage counseling. Boston Fire Commissioner Roderick Frazier has defended Chief Abrea, calling the 13 deputy chiefs unprofessional and a bunch of dinosaurs resistant to change. Meanwhile, Mayor Tom Menino also defended Abrea and says that as long as he's mayor, Chief Abrea will have a future in Boston. So sounds like this is a disagreement that might not be settled until there's a new mayor in the city. Right, Peter?
It could be. You know, hopefully there'll be some progress before then. And, you know, it'll either add up to the deputy chiefs accepting the leadership of the chief, or there being some larger decision in which the chief moves on. And it's hard to predict what it'll be.
Well, let's move on ourselves. We spoke this week to Kenneth Feinberg, the man administering the One Fund Boston, set up to help the victims of the Marathon bombing. There's more than $30 million in the fund, which will be distributed by the end of June. And it's up to Mr. Feinberg to make judgments that he says would defy Solomon. And yesterday we learned just how the money will be distributed. Top priority goes to those who lost family members, followed by double amputees, then to those suffering from brain damage, then single amputees. So tough business, this, of putting a price tag on pain and suffering. Renee, how do you think the process has been handled so far by Kenneth Feinberg.
Yeah, it is such a grim calculus, and
it really is.
You know, I'm not surprised that he makes the analogy to, you know, King Solomon, that, you know, judge who was had to split the baby. I mean, there could not be a more wrenching and difficult thing to do. On the other hand, you know, Ken Feinberg does have experience in this, another sort of grim reality, as the, you know, overseer of the fund for 9/11 and other similar.
Yeah, he's been doing this for a long time.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, he really has.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that he has a lot of credibility. It's important for the money to be moving through quickly, as he has said in your clip. You know, the question of, you know, no financial compensation for mental trauma is a difficult one, but it is, it really would slow down the whole process and complicate things if, you know, those kinds of claims were included.
You know, I was impressed, Peter. We talked to him yesterday, and what Renee just mentioned was an example of the of some of the questions I asked about what about compensation for people who weren't hurt physically but suffered emotional trauma. And he's so quick and straightforward and on and answering these difficult questions. You know, the answer is no, even though they might well deserve it. There could be thousands of them. So he said we'd be mailing out thousands of checks for $1.26 each. I mean, there's something very sort of forthright and frank and open about how Mr. Feinberg is handling this, in my view, anyway.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of the point. I think by having somebody who's really credible in this area and who has no particular biases, you know, come in and make these decisions very, very quickly, very Solomon-like, it spares a lot of backs and forths later on. And even if there are some perceived unfairnesses or some decisions that people disagree with, I think it allows the mayor and the governor to say, look, we had the right person in there. We had to make the decisions quickly. You know, there's no such thing as perfect fairness. We did the best we could. And that's probably a better outcome than dragging things out for a year and, you know, allowing sort of broad public comment on all these different claims.
Well, as Renee mentioned, he's done this before. He was in charge of funds compensating Vietnam veterans exposed to Agent Orange, survivors of 9/11, victims of shootings at Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook Elementary School, the BP oil spill. The list goes on and on. And he usually works pro bono. And he's often a lightning rod and the focus of people's frustration. So we asked him yesterday why he does this. Here's what he said.
I grew up in Massachusetts. I think public service is in the best interest of our country. You try saying no to Mayor Menino or Governor Patrick when they call and say, Ken, will you please do this for the citizens of the Commonwealth and the nation or whatever? I think thousands of people, if they were asked, they would do the exact same thing.
But they might not do it the way he does it. But what's your view, Renee, of Mr. Feinberg's willingness to take on this?
Well,
this
We're fortunate to have him. He came in to see the Globe editorial board back when after he was appointed to be the commissioner of the 9/11 fund. And I've always found him to be, you know, remarkably straightforward and credible.
Mm. Peter, agree?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he's a bit of a Paul. He used to work for Ted Kennedy and stuff. But I think he's sincere. And that statement that he made, I think, pretty much explains it.
Mm. Finally, this week, we spoke to Governor Deval Patrick about his leadership in the wake of the bombing. Among other things, we asked him about the biggest lesson he learned during those difficult days right after the bombing and the week when the city was in lockdown. And here's what he said.
One thing about crisis is that everybody wants answers, and little, if any, of the actual facts are any good. When you're in the midst of it, you're in the midst of it, and it's still unfolding, and so you can't tell the whole story because you don't know the whole story. I think really keeping your head while others around may be losing theirs may be pretty key, because it's impossible to get all the information and the facts if you yourself are hysterical.
So when it comes to this question of leadership in times of crisis, keeping your head, being cool under fire, how did the governor do, Peter?
I think the governor did very well. I think that, you know, his prime responsibility is to be, you know, a reassuring presence, to sort of communicate that the authorities have everything under control, that people are doing their best they can. And I think that sometimes, you know, admitting what you know and what you don't know actually can have a calming effect. So I think that's completely right. The one thing I would add, though, about Governor Patrick is I hope that he goes ahead and plans a truly independent commission, though, to look into what went right and what went wrong in the response to this. That right now a lot of officials are kind of basking in praise, and you know they love those positive reviews. And obviously, if there were an independent commission, it would fault some of the police departments for not coordinating well. It might look at things like the fire department dispute that we were just talking about. You know, was the chief in the right place at the right time? Inevitably, there are going to be things that weren't done right, and there'll be lessons that will be important for all of us in Massachusetts to learn for the next disaster. Patrick should go ahead and do it, even if it takes some of the glow off of the performance of all of the officials involved. And I think that will be a test of his true commitment to leadership, as opposed to just, you know, putting on a brave face.
Interesting. Yeah. Renee?
That sounds like an editorial in tomorrow's Boston Globe. I'll have to look for that. Very well put. you know, I liked elsewhere in that interview you had with the governor, your line of questioning about the tension between freedom and security.
Yep.
You know, because what continues to strike me about this, you know, a month after the bombing, is that, you know, the things that we love about living in cities are exactly the things that make us vulnerable, right? The, you know, crowds, open access, you know, a mix of people, you know, rubbing shoulders. And that tension between freedom and security, and I think you brought it up in the context of surveillance and also, you know, the lockdown, or, you know, which he doesn't like to call a lockdown, the shelter-in-place order or suggestion.
The suggestion
now
that
suggestion.
People, right, yeah. Shelter-in-place.
Sure felt like an order to me that morning. In any case, you know, that tension is evident in our society in so many ways, predating, you know, 9/11. I mean, you look at things like gun control, you know, seatbelts, helmet laws. I mean, there are those tensions that exist between what we consider to be our freedoms and laws and regulations that the government imposes on us for our own safety. And I just think that that's going to be an enduring matter for us to look back at after this settles down somewhat to see if the right balance was struck.
You know, Peter, it's a great point that Renee brings up, and maybe that's one of the things that would be reviewed in the kind of review you talked about. How do you think that sort of overall, that sort of tension between keeping people safe, requiring them to stay indoors, doing the investigation, and yet sort of respecting the, you know, the sacred values of an open society.
Well, I think there's a way that we can get everything that we want here by understanding, you know, how to be protective without being extremely visible or pushing people around and doing things. And I think of the presidential inauguration. Look, if we were able to secure an outdoor presidential inauguration and inaugural parade through the center of Washington with 700,000 people there, we should be able to secure the finish line at the Boston Marathon. And, I mean, I was there and, you know, you were aware of security everywhere, but it didn't feel like it detracted from the event. And that suggests to me that we've gotten better at these things. We've found a way to allow people to enjoy the event and actually feel safer by seeing signs of security without having people be hassled.
Mm. So let's move on finally, because we've only got a couple of minutes left, to the hubbub, that story that might have fallen below the fold this week. And Renee, let me start with you, your hubbub.
Thank you. You know, people may know Walter Gropius as a famous architect from the Bauhaus in Germany, but I think fewer people know that he spent the last 30 years of his life here in Cambridge. He was the chairman of the architecture department there, and then he became a co-founder of this firm, the Architects Collaborative, whose buildings are still all around us. Today is his 130th birthday, and there will be a party at Harvard tonight that he asked for in his will. It's been held every year on his birthday since his wake, and it is being held at the Harvard Graduate School, and it is called Gropefest.
Gropefest.
Long before others may have given a different meaning to that.
How about happy birthday, word. Walter? Okay, that's great.
It's a fine event.
Peter Canellos, your hubbub.
I don't know if Gropius has a solution to this one, but the SJC this week, the Supreme Judicial Court this week, came down with a ruling that may jeopardize the rule that says that no more than four unrelated adults can live in the same house, which is an ordinance that's designed to prevent student housing from becoming overcrowded. Certainly you can enforce fire code regulations and things that might have been relevant to that recent fire in Alston, but you can't ban so many unrelated adults from living together. I think in general that's a good rule, and it will point us towards the ultimate solution to the student housing problem, which is building more dorms. It's very important for universities, particularly as they compete with online education, to have a real campus experience. And it's helped the city, where it's happened at BU and it's happened at Northeastern, and other universities should follow suit.
All right. Well, my hubbub is in the world of sports. It goes back to the big sports story this week, that unbelievable third period comeback by the Boston Bruins to defeat the Toronto Maple Leafs and advance the NHL playoffs. We all know what happened. The Bruins were down by 3 goals with 10 minutes left, 2 goals with 80 seconds left, and somehow managed to win the game. But what struck us about this story is this unimaginable agony of those poor Toronto fans. And I'm not gloating here, because in fact their agony is not unimaginable. We know it all too well in this city. And so we spoke to Vinay Menon, a diehard Leafs fan and a writer for the Toronto Star. And here's a bit of what he said.
And, you know, as a father, I actually feel a little guilty this morning about exposing my kids to this franchise. It almost seems irresponsible.
One of
my daughters this morning said, Daddy, why do you watch hockey if it makes you so sad?
Oh, my.
That's some bad parenting right there. I mean, Leafs Nation, as our fan base is called, is essentially a republic of misery. To be a Leaf fan is to be a masochist. It is to not take an active interest in your own mental health.
Oh my, a republic of misery. So we have much to be grateful for as we head into this weekend. Peter Canellis, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe, thank you so much for joining us. Have a great
thank
weekend.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston and columnist for the Boston Globe. Great to see you in here, and have a great weekend.
Same to you. Thank you so much.
Listeners, stay with us. Up next, we hear from outgoing Boston School Superintendent Carol Johnson, and we learn how Smith & Wesson surged the top of the Boston Globe 100 list. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.